Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 3 of our discussion about Acts chapter 15. Our goal with this program is to present you biblically based material that is logical, reasonable, and mature. We hope this program will present the Bible in a way that is rational, grounded in Scripture, and easily applicable to your daily life. In this series, we are discussing the topic of Acts chapter 15. What really happened? Through the centuries of Christian doctrine, there have been many interpretations of what exactly happened in Acts chapter 15. How should Gentile believers coming to a faith in a Jewish Messiah apply that faith to their lives? In episode 2, we discussed the topic of circumcision at length. Ah, circumcision. Everyone's favorite topic, right? Did you think we were done talking about circumcision? Not even close. There are a lot more details to uncover regarding circumcision if we're able to give ourselves a proper perspective of Acts chapter 15. So for this episode, let's talk some more about the act of circumcision and what it means for us as believers. But Daniel, you might ask, I'm a female. What does circumcision have to do with me? Ah, glad you asked that question, because therein lies the real significance of this topic of discussion. Obviously, the instructions concerning physical circumcision apply strictly to males. But what circumcision represents is not exclusive to the male gender. How so? Well, that's what we plan to uncover in this episode and in the next. So let's dive into this discussion by starting at Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12 communicates to us the instructions the children of Israel were to observe leading up to the 10th plague in Egypt, the death of the firstborn, the subsequent departure from the land of Egypt after that plague, and the instruction to keep Passover throughout our generations. Verses 43 through 51 detail additional instructions that were not laid out in the first 28 verses where Adonai instructed the people on how they were to keep the Passover on that fateful night in Egypt. So let's take a look at what this passage says, starting in verse 43. This is the statute of Pesach. Kol ben nekar lo yokal bo. No foreigner shall eat of it. Now, before we read on, let's define some terms. Where we read foreigner in verse 43, it's the Hebrew phrase ben nekar. Ben means son, but what does nekar mean? This word occurs 35 times in the Tanakh, and it's almost always translated as strange, foreign, or foreigner. Perhaps the most interesting verses where this phrase ben nekar occurs is found in a passage that we read in our last episode. In Genesis chapter 17, Adonai gives Avraham the instruction to circumcise himself along with all his household. Verses 12 and 13 say, "He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money from any ben nekar, foreigner, who is not of your offspring, but he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised." Then, in verses 26 and 27, after Adonai's instructions, it says this, "That very day, Avraham and his son, Yishmael, were circumcised, and all the men of his house, those born in the house and those bought with money from a ben nekar, a foreigner, were circumcised with him." Okay, so piecing these two passages together, the one from Exodus chapter 12 and the one from Genesis 17, paints an interesting picture. Exodus chapter 12, verse 43, stated that no ben nekar, no foreigner, shall eat of the Passover. This then is seemingly contrasted with the fact that these same ben nekarot, these same foreigners, are described in the chapter concerning the instructions about circumcision. If we return to Exodus chapter 12 and look at verse 48, these two passages will end up weaving together even more significantly, and it will end up helping shed some light on this discussion. Verse 48 says, "If a yagur, a stranger, shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to Adonai, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no arel, uncircumcised person, shall eat of it." Okay, So we've seen that those who had been bought as slaves from a Ben-Nakar, a foreigner, were to be circumcised along with the rest of Avraham's household. But the Ben-Nakar, the foreigner, themselves were to be prohibited from participating in the Passover. But the Yagur, the stranger, was allowed to participate in the Passover if they were circumcised? So what then is the difference between the phrase Ben-Nakar and the word Yagur, and what can this teach us? Further, what does all this have to do with Acts chapter 15? Everything, which we're going to see. Hang in there with me. First, let's examine the difference between these two descriptions of people. The Ben-Nakar, as we discussed, is a foreigner. Specifically, a Nakri is not just someone who is from another country or another people group, but this person specifically has zero ties and zero loyalty to Israel or its land. The Nakri doesn't identify themselves with Israel in any way, and they profess no allegiance to either the nation of Israel nor to its citizens. This person may be grateful to be able to live alongside Israel within the same general borders, but aside from the ability to peacefully coexist with Israel and potentially gain financially from that relationship, they have no other affinity toward Israel. This description would fit, as an example, many of the foreign traders who would journey from country to country buying and selling wares or goods, or merchants that had taken up residence among the children of Israel in order to profit financially from their proximity to the Israeli citizenry. This type of person, due to their lack of genuine interest in Israel, aside from their ability to gain from their relationship with them, fell under a certain category of rules. We can see this from numerous passages in the Torah, such as Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 21, Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 2 and 3, and Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 20. Deuteronomy 14, verse 21 says, "You shall not eat anything that has died naturally. You may give it to the lagar, sojourner, who is within your towns, that he may eat of it, or you may sell it to a nakri, foreigner." Now, this verse is about a clean animal, so a cow, a sheep, maybe a goat, or some type of a clean bird that for whatever reason has died of its own accord, and you came across its lifeless form. You can either give it to the ger, and he can eat it, or you can sell it to the nakri. Why the distinction between giving to the ger and selling to the nakri? Well, as we look at the differences between these two statuses, it's going to become more clear as to why there is this distinction. But the relationship between the children of Israel and the Nakri was almost always fiscal coexistence. Along these same lines, Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 1 through 3, speaking of the Shemitah year, says, "At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release. And this is the manner of the Shemitah, of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbor. He shall not exact of his neighbor, his brother, because Adonai's release has been proclaimed. Of a Nakri, of a foreigner, you may exact it. But whatever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release." So this passage tells us that every 7 years, you are to forgive the debt of your fellow citizen of Israel. But the foreigner who is in your midst, for no other reason than to profit financially from their relationship with you, you don't have to forgive their debts, according to this passage. Now, while this may sound like a double standard, it's simply stating that the foreigner, should you extend them the same courtesy that you would your brother, would then likely proceed to attempt to take advantage of you in this scenario. Special consideration was only offered to those who were in covenant with both you and with Adonai. And that is an incredibly critical point to keep in mind as we move forward, because it plays a huge factor in this entire discussion. This theme is repeated in Deuteronomy chapter 23. Verse 20 says, "You may charge l'nakri, a foreigner, interest, but you may not charge your brother interest, that Adonai your Elohim may bless you in all that you undertake." In this passage, we see another example that the nakri is treated differently than those who are in covenant. So by these witnesses, we can safely establish that the Nakri is a person who is not in covenant with Adonai, and thus, Not only do the instructions found within the Torah not apply to them, but they are also not privy to the benefits of the blessings that belong to those who are in covenant with him. So how then does the Nakri differ from the Ger? Both of these Hebrew words end up being translated into our English versions as either stranger or foreigner, and they both communicate someone who is not part of the Commonwealth of Israel, but there are some important differences here. Both of these terms refer to people who are not descendants of Yaakov, and thus, they represent people who are out of covenant with Adonai. So how do these two terms differ from one another? The term ger is used 92 times in the Tanakh, and it's used in some very interesting passages. As an example, in Genesis 23, when Avraham negotiates with the Hittites for a parcel of land where he can bury his wife, he says about himself, "I am a ger, a sojourner, and a toshav, a foreigner." Now that status of toshav we might talk about at a later time. "I am a ger, a sojourner, and a toshav, a foreigner, among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." So in that passage, Avraham refers to himself as a ger. We also see from Exodus chapter 2, verse 22, that Moshe names his son Gershom, because, "For he said, I have been a ger, a sojourner, in a nakriya, foreign land." In that verse, we have both of these words used together, ger and nakri, but they're translated differently because they mean different things. This then brings us back to a chapter we've already read from, Exodus chapter 12. We read from verse 45 earlier, which said, "No nakri, no foreigner may eat of it," referring to the Passover. That was the verse that got us started on this episode's topic of discussion. But there's something very interesting that's stated in verse 48. Before we read verse 48, though, let's first read verse 19. All these clues are going to come together soon, I promise. Verse 19 says, "For 7 days, no leaven is to be found in your houses. If anyone eats what is leavened, that person will be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a ger, a sojourner, or a native of the land." From this verse, we can see that the status of ger, although it signifies someone who is foreign-born, it also indicates that this person was considered part of the congregation of Israel. After all, why would a sojourner be mentioned here if there was no threat that they could be cut off from the congregation, just as the native-born could be? You know, kind of like how Paul described it in Romans chapter 11. But we'll get into that in an upcoming episode. The implication here is that the ger could be cut off from the congregation, and this implies something completely different and distinct from what we learned about the Nakri. The ger was included among the nation. A ger is a person who, although they were born outside of the covenants, they've chosen to attach themselves to the nation of Israel. This ger has been accepted as part of the Israelite society. Now, this ger had no land ownership rights. Thus, they were generally hired as laborers, or they could potentially own their own business or trade that they operate within Israel, but they didn't have all the same rights and privileges that citizens of Israel had. The ger was not a slave, but they also weren't considered a full member. Similar in a lot of respects to the topic of Roman citizenry that we can see in the New Testament. When we see Paul invoke his status as a Roman citizen in Acts chapters 21 through 23, the soldiers and the government officials that are dealing with him instantly reduce the severity of their treatment towards him. Why? Because within the Roman Empire, those who held citizen status enjoyed greater privileges and rights than those who weren't Roman citizens. In the same way, the native-born Israelite had greater rights and privileges than the ger did within Israeli society. Eventually, if a ger remained loyal and faithful to Israel for long enough, they would end up being adopted into the tribe where they dwelt, and they would become accepted as achieving that full citizen status. So aside from land ownership, what other differences were there between the ger and the native-born? Well, the suggestion throughout the Torah is that the ger desired to dwell among the children of Israel, that they were subject to all the prohibitions found within the Torah. In other words, they had to follow all the negative commands, all the don't do this, don't do that kind of instructions. But if they desired more than that, if they expressed a desire to also follow the positive commandments, such as participating in the festivals that their fellow native-born Israelis would have been enjoying, it would require them to do so exactly and specifically the way the Torah instructed them to. That brings us back to Exodus chapter 12. In verse 48, which we looked at a few minutes ago, it said, "If a yagur, a stranger, shall sojourn with you, and would keep the Passover to Adonai, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no arel, uncircumcised person, shall eat of it." If a ger wanted to participate in Passover, it required circumcision, because no one who was arel, uncircumcised, could participate. Was this circumcision considered to be a step that was necessary for salvation? No, that's not what this passage is about. It's about participation in the Feast of Passover. And keep this in mind, because when we get to discussing Acts chapter 15, especially in verse 21, this is going to come up again. One very interesting note to point out, though, is that immediately following this instruction, if the ger desired to participate in the Passover meal, there's this instruction from verse 49, "There shall be one law for the native and for Hagar, the stranger who sojourns among you." This statement is the first of three times that this phrase is used in the Tanakh. The other two times, it appears in Numbers chapter 15, which we discussed in our series on the Sabbath. Numbers chapter 15, verse 16 and verse 29 both say that Torah Echad, one law, u'mishpat Echad, and one rule shall be for you and for V'lager Hager, the stranger who sojourns with you. Now, what's interesting about these verses is that the first example from Exodus chapter 12 is given within the context of a ger who wishes to participate in Passover. The other two examples, both from Numbers chapter 15, are given within the context of bringing offerings to the tabernacle and keeping Shabbat holy. So based upon this, we can see that there's already a pattern that is established for those who are from among the nations who desire to become joined to Israel. But there's also another pattern that emerges from examining these passages. Adonai desires that those who are strangers and far off would be able to draw near to him. This brings us back to Romans chapter 4. We looked at this passage of scripture in our previous episode, but it bears repeating. Let's read that passage again. "Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom Adonai will not count his sin." Is this blessing then only for the circumcised or also for the uncircumcised? For we say that faith was counted to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it counted to him? Was it before or after he had been circumcised? It was not after, but before he was circumcised. He received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the father of all who believe without being circumcised, so that righteousness would be counted to them as well, and to make him the father of the circumcised, who are not merely circumcised, but who also walk in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. The faith that Abraham demonstrated occurred before he was circumcised. Likewise, the ger who exercises that same faith will be considered righteous while in his uncircumcised state, the same way that Abraham was. But as we have already established, circumcision is about much more than simply a mark in the flesh. Circumcision, as we discussed in our last episode, indicates someone or something that's devoted to Adonai, whereas uncircumcision is represented as something that has not yet been devoted to Adonai. But as we looked at with the examples of the fruit trees in our previous episode, this status is not obtained or changed by merely a physical circumcision. Circumcision is merely a sign. It's an outward sign of something that should be taking place inwardly. This theme is replete throughout Scripture. We see this concept first expressed in the book of Deuteronomy in two different passages. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 16, Moshe tells the children of Israel, "Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart, and be no longer stubborn." We then see in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 6, "And Adonai your Elohim will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love Adonai your Elohim with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live." Well, these are some awfully weird and frightening descriptions. I mean, I trust that Adonai is an amazing surgeon, but is he speaking here of literally cutting off a portion of our hearts? Is he speaking of literal things here? Of course not. In our previous episodes on the topic of what is the gospel, we discussed at length how when we see the word heart in Scripture, we have to view it in the way that we would currently speak about our brains. In the Bible, the heart represented the seat of intellect and thought. This communicates to us that it's speaking about that upon which we dwell, where our thoughts are drawn to and focused upon. So when Moshe is telling the children of Israel that they should circumcise their hearts and that Adonai will circumcise their hearts, it's speaking about their thoughts, what they consume their thoughts with. This is a reference to what they inwardly devote their thoughts of their minds to, which will then end up being reflected by their outward behavior. This is echoed by Yeshua when he said in Luke chapter 6, verse 45, that the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil, for out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. Thus, when Moshe spoke of having a circumcised heart, he was talking about having an inward thought life that resulted in outward behavior, just like Yeshua described in that passage from Luke. Specifically, behavior that demonstrated that you love Adonai your Elohim with all your heart and with all your soul. This concept is further established then with multiple other passages from Scripture, such as Joshua chapter 22, verse 5, which says, "Only be very careful to observe the commandment and the law that Moshe, the servant of Adonai, commanded you, to love Adonai your Elohim, and to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments, and to cling to him, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." Also, we have examples like this from Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 4, which says, "Circumcise yourselves to Adonai. Remove the foreskin of your hearts, O men of Yehuda and inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my wrath go forth like fire and burn with none to quench it because of the evil of your deeds." These passages identify the circumcision of the heart with devotion to Adonai and his ways. What does a circumcised heart look like, though? I don't mean literally, of course, but rather, what does the life of someone who has a circumcised heart look like? We can see our answer to that question. It's actually coming from numerous passages that speak about this very situation. This is what the prophet Ezekiel describes in his 11th chapter. "I will give them one heart, and a new spirit I will put within them. I will remove the heart of stone from their flesh, and give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes, and keep my rules, and obey them. And they shall be my people, and I will be their Elohim." So, we'll receive a heart transplant? Is that what Adonai is describing here? Kind of, yeah. The prophet Ezekiel describes later, in chapter 36, what this will look like. "I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the countries and bring you into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean from all your uncleanness, and from all your idols I will cleanse you. And I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh, and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you, and cause you to walk in my statutes, and be careful to obey my rules. You shall dwell in the land that I gave your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I will be your Elohim." I'm starting to see a pattern develop here. The prophet Jeremiah also expresses this same sentiment when describing the new covenant. "For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Yisrael after those days, declares Adonai. I will put my Torah, my law, within them, and write it on their hearts. And I will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people." So this passage is speaking of the Torah being written upon the heart, Again, understanding that the heart represents what one thinks upon and about, this communicates that the Torah would be what consumes your thought life. So far, we've seen from Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 16, and chapter 30, verse 6, that a circumcised heart, which we should understand as referring to a thought life that is devoted to Adonai, that this circumcised heart results in the removal of stubbornness, as well as behavior that displays that we love Adonai with all of our being. Joshua 22, verse 5 suggests that this status also results in walking in all of Adonai's ways, keeping his commandments, and clinging to Adonai and serving him with everything that we have. Then Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 4, and Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 33 indicate that when this circumcised heart status is achieved, that we will turn from evil and he will write his Torah upon our hearts, which means that it will become our very meditation and that we will be his people and he will be our Elohim. Ezekiel chapters 11, verses 19 and 20, and chapter 36, verses 24 through 28 say that when we receive these new circumcised hearts, that we will walk in his statutes and obey his rules. And then it repeats the thoughts of Jeremiah that we will be his people and he will be our Elohim. It would appear based upon these passages then that the running theme here is that one circumcises their heart, their thoughts, and thus their entire life will end up revolving around and serving, obeying Adonai and his expressed will. This is further supported by Solomon's words in Proverbs chapters 3 and 7. Proverbs 3, verses 1 through 3 says, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Let not steadfast love and faithfulness forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart." And then four chapters later, in chapter 7, verses 1 through 3, it says, "My son, keep my words and treasure up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teaching as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart." So 300 years roughly before Jeremiah prophesied about the new covenant and the Torah being written upon one's heart, Solomon spoke of the very same thing. In both occasions, this is associated with being devoted to Adonai and to keep his commandments. In fact, Adonai spoke further on this topic through the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 9. In chapter 9, Adonai makes the connection for us to link all these things together. Circumcision in the flesh is, as we have discussed, merely an outward sign of what is supposed to have happened inwardly. Specifically, this is a reference to devoting one's thoughts, and thus one's behavior, to Adonai and becoming intentionally obedient to his instructions. Circumcision isn't a badge of honor or some type of achievement that we should boast about. The fact is that it's placed upon the most private part of a man's body, and it speaks to this, an area that only himself, his spouse, and potentially his parents would be aware of. But someone who is living with a circumcised heart would be easy to identify. Their behavior becomes the very sign that a physical circumcision is supposed to represent. So the physical sign isn't what's significant. The inward circumcision is what's important. Adonai expresses this at the end of Jeremiah chapter 9, which says, "Thus says Adonai, let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man boast in his might. Let not the rich man boast in his riches. But let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am Adonai, who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, declares Adonai. Behold, the days are coming, declares Adonai, when I will punish all those who are circumcised merely in the flesh. Egypt, Judah, Edom, the sons of Ammon, Moab, and all who dwell in the desert who cut the corners of their hair. For all those nations are Arel, uncircumcised, and all the house of Israel are Arel, uncircumcised in heart." What we see from these verses is that physical circumcision is not a guarantee that you're saved. Circumcision of the heart is what leads to salvation. According to Jeremiah, those who are circumcised merely in the flesh are no better than those who are from among the nations, who, in their uncircumcised hearts, defy the commandments of Adonai. In fact, in this passage, we saw that Judah, a reference to the southern kingdom, and the house of Israel, a reference to the northern kingdom, are both counted among the other descendants of Abraham, who may very well have practiced physical circumcision as well, but who rejected serving Adonai. From this passage, coupled with all the others we've looked at in this episode and in the last, we can say with certainty that outward physical circumcision is of zero benefit if it's not understood as merely a sign of what has taken place internally. Specifically, that one's heart has been changed and is completely devoted to Adonai. This means that one's thought life is focused on serving Adonai and following his instructions, which then leads to blessing and results in his calling us his own special treasured possession. We will be known as his people, and he will be our Elohim. Now that we have a proper understanding of the purpose and function of what circumcision represents, we are finally ready to return our focus to Acts chapter 15 and discuss the role circumcision had in that conversation. But for that, you'll have to tune in to our next episode. Until then, shalom.
Hi, I'm Kimberly with Lion and Lamb Ministries, and I am so excited to tell you about our new program on lionandlamb.tv. It's called Come to the Table. You know, some of life's best conversations happened around a table. Whether it's the kitchen table, your dining room table, or even just having a cup of coffee on your couch. On Come to the Table, we'll talk openly about real life issues on our messianic walk. Faith, family, and everything in between. And I'll introduce you to some friends of mine who are walking out their calling in powerful ways. So pull up a chair and join me every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on lionandlamb.tv. Come to the table and let's do life together.